Another episode of the Research Conversations podcast with host V. Vale and guest Christopher Coppola.
Welcome, Christopher Coppola. Thank you for driving all the way over here from beautiful Marin.
Well, Mill Valley. I like to be specific with the little town.
We're all together because we want to find out how easy it is to become a filmmaker. So everyone listening will want to make films in sort of the George Cuchar spirit.
Well, George Cuchar was my teacher back in 82, 83, up to the fall of 85. And the thing that was, you know, brilliant about George is, what I think he made like 400 movies. And you know, some of the movies were made in class. I was in a few of those. One was called Club Vatican. I was a piano player, priest. I was in a few. I can't remember. His names can be, that was an easy one to remember, but sometimes his names get a little rococo, odd. He'd make a film, you know, they were 16 millimeter, and all the students were in it. He made the students feel like stars. He'd bring people off the street and other actors like Marion Eaton. And who's the woman that was in Sacred
Blood? Linda Martinez.
Linda Martinez. What an awesome actress. What a character. But then the school kept cutting his budgets down, trying to phase him out. But then he went into video. And started making films for like $15, $20 without the budgets with the class. And you just couldn't stop them. And then his budgets got back up. But one of the things that was brilliant about George, which is what isn't easy, is that he would shoot in camera and rewind and get his other shot. So he would edit in camera. He knew exactly where to rewind and put a shot in. And if you look at the little video that he makes on his own, The Cage of Nicholas, which I'm in, and I'm staying at my brother's house on Franklin. It was Werner Erhard's house at one point. So there was all kinds of secret passageways because Werner Erhard was scared that L. Ron Hubbard was trying to kill him. The Scientologist took from Est, as we all know. Bizarre stuff, right? But anyhow, he shot this piece, George shot this piece, Cage of Nicholas. And he literally says, there's going to be a glitch. And all of a sudden you see a glitch on the videotape because he knew exactly when that was going to happen. But all I saw him do was rewind and, you know, do that and say it. So he knew exactly what was happening on the tape, what cuts. And I thought that's not easy to do. And one of the things that I do, being the head of the film department and, you know, teaching classes there, was to teach students how to do the same thing. There's still celluloid at the Art Institute, and we have a developer. And I think it's great that students could do the old school and, you know, touch the cellular, but we live in a digital arena now, and it's very important that they also learn the tools. And that's what people are going to use to make movies is digital, because it's a million times cheaper and much more accessible. For example, if you shoot celluloid, you know, most people will not have a projector at home and they will not have an editing system, so it'll have to be digitized and they'd have to cut digitally anyway. And the point is why? You know, why shoot film then? Because I could make the digital look like any ASA I want. But it's still great that students can learn how to light digitally and light with celluloid, which you can learn from both. But my point being is, yes, everybody has a filmmaker inside. Tools are out there. You can get very cheap digital cameras. You can get editing software and projectors, you know, that don't cost much money. And basically, you know, make movies. Now, the beauty of that, there's a lot of films that are being made, and there's a glut of them that are really bad. And so the good ones still surface to the top. So you have to have a good story. You have to have originality and ideas. And you can practice, which in the old days, John Ford, who's one of my heroes, he made a ton of movies. They short movies and serials. And so they can really hone their craft. Celluloid's too expensive, but with digital, young people, older people can make a film like every day with their cell phone. And they have editing apps on the cell phone and practice their ideas, practice their, you know, educating their eye, and basically maybe be one of those people that bubbles up and can make a living doing it. But besides that, I think it's important that everybody does do that because I call it cinematic syntax, how to be articulate, because we do live in a world now where we communicate cinematically. If you look online, Everybody's using videos, YouTube, and the ones that are the most articulate are the ones that help you get your point across globally, your feelings, your ideas, community. I did this with the Braille Institute, too, with kids that couldn't see at all. And they said, well, nobody would give us a camera, but, you know, we can see. And you brought us cameras. And so I taught them the cinematic syntax, which is three shots, the wide angle, the close-up, and the moving shot. You can basically make your points with those three shots. You can also edit them in ways that it looks like you have six original shots. And so that way, when you do that, it's very clear and articulate, and the syntax is there so that people around the world, maybe if even turn the sound off, get a sense of what you're about. So in that sense, I think it's important that everybody kind of play around with the filmmaking experience, because we deal in a visual world now, and I would say a cinematic world. And so part of what I teach my students is to do that every day, you know, to develop themselves, what I call cell phone films, cell phone art, where you make a film, a one-minute film in camera, no pausing, no editing, exactly 60 seconds about a theme. You know, like, what is beauty? But you can block it. Blocking means, you know, where your characters move in it, and which character you follow. You know, the great Orson Welles would do one shot. You know, if you look at Citizen Kane, really wide shots that had great depth of field. So when they would walk up to the camera, you had a close-up, but when they walked to the back of the room, you'd have a wide angle, and it would all be in focus. So one shot, you can essentially get two shots without cutting, just by moving the characters around. So anyway, that's a long way of answering your question, but I'm a real believer in the fact that I think it's important that not only is it fun to make movies and it's available to you and accessible, but you should. Does that make sense to you?
I like the notion of, you know, film a day like a vitamin pill.
Exactly.
Like it kind of nourishes you.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's all creative process is nourishing. I mean, that's what we do as humans. We create. And whether, you know, you're doing painting or sculpture, it's very healing. It creates empowerment, self-empowerment. But I'm really into the idea that, you know, doing the film, you know, if you can't paint, if you can't sculpt, if you can't write a piece of music, though I do think everything has a sound wave, and, you know, we can get into that at some point. I see film as just a form of music, but you can make a film. You know, anybody can do it with the shots and with the cameras out there. And so that's digital empowerment is what I call it. And I know some of the things that make me most happy in life, especially the older I get, is when I take my digital film festival, Project Accessible Hollywood, hands-on digital film festival around the world. A little kid would come up to me and say, hey, Mr. Kobel, I didn't know I could direct a film. Or, you know, some underserved kid in Belize that I didn't even know I could edit. And that makes me feel great, you know. And everybody has internet, you know, so that you can share that around the world. So for me, it's empowerment as well. You give these people a voice because you can put their videos up online. Sincerity from the heart. You know, I think that is empowering. I also teach the concept of think it, shoot it, share it. I mean, don't take things for granted. There's a place for throwing out garbage, you know, watching a mother feed mush to a baby for 5 minutes and the baby spitting it up, that you see stuff like that on YouTube. And there's a place for that, you know. But for me, like, you know, why take that for granted? It's a gift for you to be able to make something and put it up online and everybody in the world can see it. So why not think about it first? Why not think about yourself and what your ideas are and your community again? And then, you know, shoot it. And then you share it to everybody. And that's another thing that I really believe in, the think it, shoot it, share it concept.
I like three-word phrases.
Yeah, it's good. How do you like documenting the history of now? That's another one I just came up with.
Well, I've always said that everything I do is instant history.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there is no now.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. We could argue a little bit about that, but I find that concept, once you do it, it's already the past. I get that. But some people would agree there isn't any past or future. There's echoes
Well, we could get into a Heideggerian discussion of what time really means and all that forever, but I think most people would get extremely bored extremely quickly. But you know, cinema is obviously a medium that exists in time, and one of the things I like most, and in fact I like it most in music, and it's kind of rare still, is when, like, I was in a band, Blue Cheer, and one of the things we did that no one did was we would slow down a piece and then we'd slowly speed it up. And I always wondered why that didn't happen more in cinema as well.
You mean playing with time, speeding up footage, slowing footage down. It does in experimental film. I don't like labels, though. I mean, the idea of experimental, the idea of narrative. I mean, you know, everything we do, in my feeling, is narrative. Even if you take a piece of celluloid and draw on it, you're making a choice. When you make a choice, it's a narrative. So I don't like labels. But I like to say nonlinear and linear. Nonlinear, I think that's when you do experiment with speed, you know, and you can learn from that nonlinear filmmaking where you're not following the beats and the arc of a story. Whereas a nonlinear, you don't do that. You experiment with speed, with color, but often that can be used in linear when you have a montage that is needed to make a point, to follow a beat, slowing something down like a dream sequence or, you know, something, or speeding something up because the heart's racing. I like to do that, like I just did, you know, the feature film Sacred Blood, which your wife, lovely wife Marion Wallace, cut. After that, I did this jungle movie, which I'm still waiting for, but I came up with ideas of psychological ideas, subliminal. I'm really into the idea of the subliminal, which you can learn from nonlinear, but my two characters have different ways of seeing things. One suffers from panic disorder, from a mental illness, and the other suffers from being fixated on treasure. I mean, he can't help it. That's all he wants. So what I would do is for the young lady, and you shoot something that's done linear, and it's, you know, like us talking here, it's very clear from the shot we're here in the now talking, but you may be getting sick to your stomach with what I'm saying. And so I may then take your point of view of me, even though it doesn't have a lens, you know, and have it move around, you know, without attaching it, to create this weird, you know, surreal going out of focus, going into focus, because I'm making you nauseous. And then I may, because I'm fixating on the fact that I know you can't pay me any money for this, you know, I'm just kidding, but I may put a telephoto on it, and what that would do is compress you to, like, the background's right up against you so that I see a wall. And so, like, I may say, God, what am I going to do? Speaking feels, raising money, and this is just another, and I'm feeling trapped. Well, that's exactly what happens in the thing. I'm just kidding, by the way. I do this for free to everybody, so don't take me seriously. I was just giving you an example, you know. Okay? We cool with that? Are we cool with that?
Sure. Why not? Everything's free.
Everything has
the
to
air
be.
Is free the so air is, far.
Well, you know, so far. So far.
And water
is not all, free.
Not in India. They line up and pay for it there, but
so do we.
But
water, we pay for it. I just paid a bill for $375 for PG&E and water.
Water is usually a separate bill, Christopher. Well, in San Francisco.
Oh, okay. I'm just thinking L.A. then. Okay. Well, whatever.
Whatever.
I don't know these things. I mean, I should, but I don't know. I'm a horrible businessman.
No! Don't say that. Don't be trapped by that. I predict you're going to become a great businessman.
Oh, really? Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. Well, they all kind of cross collateralize because I teach film. I have a professional production company that does these low budget films, and I have the nonprofit PAW, which takes the digital filmmaking, hence filmmaking on the road. So they all kind of cross pollinize, and because of that, I was actually hired from Intel to speak on their stage at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which is the largest show in the world. I believe there was, like, I don't know, 300,000 people go to that, and so I, you know, they walked through, and I was speaking three times about 360 filmmaking, you know, virtual reality filmmaking, because that is the future, but how do you still tell stories that way? How do you stay in charge of it and not just be plugged in? And so I teach that. I was given the name the Digivangelist a long time ago by Jenny Jardin. I don't know if Wired knows it. It's a boing boing blog.
Yeah.
She gave me that a long time ago and it kind of stuck. So I do have these little monikers too. Pirate of the Coppola family, because I just do my thing. But
and you look like a pilot visually. Pirate, I mean.
Yeah.
Pilot
yeah.
and pirate. Hey, they almost rhyme.
They do rhyme. Pilot. Well, because
pirate,
I'm on a journey.
Pilot and pirate.
Well, because you're on a journey. You know, boat journey, you know, motorcycle boat, creative journey. I am into the adventure, definitely.
But you also pilot a plane, like when you make a film, there's a huge crew aboard your plane. And
even a bigger one on a boat, though.
Or on a boat. Oh, yeah, the pilot of a boat.
Yeah.
I suppose I called that the captain, but it's a pilot too.
Oh, yeah. You know, and also running a circus, which I'm very much into. I'd be the ringmaster. That's a big deal. You know?
They have slightly nuanced, specific terms.
Yeah, yeah, and they kind of all go together: pirate, carny, circus, poet, philosopher. All those kind of mixed together in a bag, jumbled up. You kind of get me.
Pirate, pilot, I like.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll add pilot to the.
Add it to the bag. And it's also alliterative.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of alliteration.
Yeah, that's true. You are.
Wherever it crops its, you know, persnickety head.
Yeah. What else was I going to tell you about the fact that people should be making
movies? What's 360 film? I'm unclear in that concept.
Well, what it is a series of cameras that make a globe. And when you shoot, you see the entire environment around you, behind, up, below, all around.
So it has to be up high, kind of.
Well, you have to figure out where to put it. You could put it on the ground too, but where to put it if you don't want to be in it. You know, you have to figure that out. But yeah, I wouldn't directly on the ground. The only reason why that can work is you're still going to have a small spot, and you'd have an area on the ground where you know, the bottom, only 10% isn't seen. And you could put, you know, because it's a globe, you know, so you only have that little point, what do you call that, the two points of the globe.
The axis.
Axis, but the North Pole and South Pole type of thing. You know, that area would be very tiny. And so if you want to get that real close up on the ground where you maybe see like the blades of grass, but then it goes up to the sky, you get the full nature effect. But this is going to be the future of filmmaking. It's going to take a while. They always look for that gimmick in Hollywood because, you know, they did the various forms of 3D. But the video game world is far bigger than the film world. I mean, it's a huge business. They make more money than film. Campuses are bigger. A big one, Electronic Arts, is up here in Redwood City. But the youth, they're growing up with video games where they're very used to interacting with the game, like going into separate rooms, going backwards, going forwards, and seeing, being able to click and see the whole room, you know. So how do you tell a story that way? And that's what I'm very interested in. How do you tell a narrative that you can be with one actor and follow that path, another actor follow that path into different globes, having it all part of an overall story? Just talk about it, the creative idea that's easy to comprehend because, you know, you can go to the film, the same film, like 10 times and have a different experience, which means you'd make more money from the same film. Because of the experience you would have, but the technical aspect is I don't completely know where that's going and how it'll be done, but I know it will be. But it would be a globe, kind of like IMAX, but a full globe with a bunch of seats at the very bottom at that South Pole point, and the chairs would move around. Now the question is, you know, the sound will be tricky, but they're investigating. There's already ways to do the sound. A company called Jaunt VR, which is makes this incredible 360 camera with, I believe, 18 cameras, which I'm hoping to experiment with. They have a system where the sound can move with the way you move. The issue is, how does an audience, without wearing goggles, when they turn, get to go into these other rooms? There has to be something with body movement the actual, like, you know, beaming of the body movement would let people go that direction once it hits a specific point if you follow that character. So it would open a door with the body motion. You know, there are things now that kind of do that. When you wave, you know, you have we and all this kind of stuff. So I think it's going to be something like that. So anyhow, the point is this stuff is going to happen. It's what you would have to, you know, do, though, is how do you stay in charge of it? How do you write meaningful stories? I remember being on the Independent Film Committee with the Directors Guild, which I'm a member, which I'm a true independent filmmaker. You know, the only film that had some association with the studio was Deadfall with Trimark, which was a disaster for me, but now it's become kind of like this cult movie. Most of my films do become like cult movies, which is cool. I like cult movies. But that was Trimark, which later on became Lionsgate. But all my films have been independent. Where was I going with this? What was I talking about?
Well, you were talking about the future of 360 filmmaking.
Yeah, but there was a reason that I went back to my company.
Because it's hard to sustain a narrative?
Yeah. I mean, I literally, with my company, have been able to raise money to do my own thing. And so with the Directors Guild of America, I mean, I'm a real independent filmmaker, and it's the Independent Filmmakers Committee. And they had people like Soderbergh on it. I mean, how's that an independent filmmaker?
I thought he started out as one.
I know, but he's making, like, you know, Ocean's 11, and he's on the committee. Except Soderbergh was into the, you know, where things were going. But a lot of the other people, they would say, like the two directors that made Little Miss Sunshine, it was a man and a woman, but I don't want to go there. They would say, you know, if they had their way, they would kill every millennial kid for destroying cinema. And I'm like, you know, you guys will be dinosaurs because, you know, it's all going to change. And if you don't know how to evolve, you're not going to be working. And my point is, you have to evolve, because if you don't evolve, our youth, our millennials, are not going to get the wisdom of elder ideas. So that's what I was saying. That's where it went back. You know, I take tangents sometimes. My dad did that. You know, my dad, August, took a lot of tangents, but eventually they would come back and make sense. Any other questions for me?
Yeah.
Want to talk about what I teach now?
No.
Okay. Later, I want to talk about my SFAI Chance Ensemble, which makes use of film and found instruments and made instruments.
C-H-A-N-C-E?
Chance. Like John Cage making use of chance, aleatoric, chance equations.
Okay, because I also heard the word chance, C-H-A-N-T-S. So I didn't know what you meant.
Well, there are some moments where chant can work in the vocal. It's like a monkey chant kind of thing.
And chants are pretty free. You don't need any instruments. Just need your voice.
Yeah, but the fun of chants is the equations you come up with, and also the fun of the class is making instruments, like water instruments, cigar box instruments, trash instruments, things like that. You know, and the class really enjoys it. And then they make film based on chants, but there's always a theme. And then the film is cut together based on chance projected, and we, the ensemble, realizes the film as sound. So you're watching, I think maybe Marion came to one of those concerts, and the students really love it because it teaches them how to be in the moment, how to listen, how to capture. You know, once it can be done, you know, through infinity. I mean, it's always different. But you can tell when it's working and when it's not working. So I wanted to get back to that because you brought up, you know, it's the past already, but this is the now chance. And once it's performed, it's the past. Because, you know, we have issues on that concept of there is no, you know.
I like the idea of being spontaneous, which maybe you've taken almost to a fault. Because if you take too many takes of actors improvising, I think that can sure as hell complicate the editing later.
Well, I mean, I was talking pretty much about the music on this. There aren't any actors, but I like improv for certain things. And in some of the greatest directors, including my uncle, he would do improv to, like, get actors to quit acting, to be in the moment, to be completely, in tune with the character, you know, from the inside to the outside. And doing improv helps to do that. It breaks away, you know, all the preconceived ideas you have of the character. It breaks away films you're already thinking about to draw from. It forces you to be the character right then and there. And it's scary, but that scariness also adds. But yes, it is difficult to cut that. I mean, Cassavetes did it all the time. It just takes longer, and you know, dialogue changes. But all good editing is about cutting on energy, and really, you should be able to turn, again, the sound off and follow what's going on in terms of the body language and the energy, and then the dialogue and the sound is also part of that. But I always look at, you know, when you're on an airplane and you don't want to buy the movie, but you don't want to look at a movie, but you can't help somebody across the way is looking at a movie, and you just, because it's a video monitor, you can't help looking at it. Every once in a while, I look at something and I'm like, you know, I'm into it, even though I can't hear anything. And that's a good edit.
Oh, it ought to be, but I'm shocked whenever I do that, how modern day films, there seems to be such fast cutting all the time, and I don't really like that.
No, and it's a problem. It's a youth thing. They have no attention spans. We do. I mean, I asked my students what they want to listen to, you know, Wagner's Ring. You know, they said, absolutely not. I couldn't sit through it. And then, you know, I listen to opera all the time, but I particularly like Alvin Berg, you know, Lulu and Wozzeck. Obviously, Mozart's, you know, Magic Flute, partly because it's based on Masonic principles, and I'm a Freemason, so there's lots of going on there. Well, what about you? I mean, you did a little, you're starting to edit a little bit. You're starting to shoot some stuff. I know Marion edited my film, but you guys are starting to make little, I mean, Marion was an experimental, non-linear filmmaker at the Art Institute. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing that as well. You're now starting to cut and put music on it, aren't you? Mr. Vale?
No. Hell no.
He just plays the music.
But you make decisions cutting the visuals too.
I don't. Yeah, Marion does.
You have to have some ideas. I mean, I don't believe that. I mean, knowing you, I believe that you would make mistakes.
I don't know. You have to work with someone you can trust who is also extremely content-oriented, not just form-oriented.
Yeah.
Because you want certain content that's... You want the most important content somehow to end up in what you call the film or video.
What I like to do, and it's true, you want a team that... I like to give a list of ingredients out for the overall project, what the major theme is, what the ingredients are. And then I like, for me, I like to sit on it. It's kind of like osmosis. It all goes up my ass. And I'm ready.
Don't explain that too much.
I'm just saying I like to sit on the paper. And then I don't look at it again. It's in my being. You know, I don't know how other crew members, that they do it too, but not. I don't know if it's necessarily that. I learned that from some actors, William Forsythe and Gary Busey. They did osmosis, and there's certain directors that also did osmosis, and it kind of works. You just sit on it. You know, talk, but sit on it.
I'm more of a fan of sleeping on it, like you know, taking a nap or... The next morning, I'll wake up with everything that's wrong.
Right.
It all just hit you like a ton of bricks, and you go to fix it. It's the wonderful miracle of the subconscious that all of us has, or the unconscious, or whatever generates dreams, but also gives you a flood of wake-up calls. As soon as you wake up, you know everything that was sort of a mistake or that you want to improve or whatever. As soon as you wake up, it just hits you, and you better dash to the computer and fix it.
Yeah, I think that's true. But also, I keep the other versions too, because often the versions that aren't fixed are better than the versions that are so-called fixed.
Well, that's because your film.
Well, I do that musically too. I do it with.
Well,
writing.
Then you can release. Let's pretend you're a musician. Then you can.
Oh,
I know, yeah. But you know, everyone is.
I said that earlier.
Everyone's a musician.
Yeah, but I wrote an opera, Plato's Cave. I wrote a clarinet quintet. I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. I wrote serious.
Yeah, but where are all the CD and D releases?
Well, I have them on reel to reel, but I didn't spend my time trying to sell them. You know, that wasn't my. I mean, you were a punk rock guy.
Well, no, we want to distribute our stuff. Okay. If we do stuff, we want other people to.
Well, Jim Fox, who was one of the students at the University of Redlands, you know, he does Cold Blue Records and distributes all the music of, you know, new music, experimental music. You guys should go to Cold Blue Records and check it out. But Morton Feldman, I mean, David Mislanka, Marty Walker, there's, you know, all the filmmakers, Harold Budd, all that period of California new music is documented on those records. And our teacher, Barney Childs, who I studied composition with, and so did he did one called Clay Music, all with ocarinas, you know, which is really good. So I get it. I get the idea. He just never offered to make a record of my music, and I haven't, you know, I wrote something 3 years ago called Orange Moon. I was commissioned. Oh, and you're going to like this. I was commissioned by my piano teacher's professor emeritus, Luann Long, at the University of Redlands. It was for 8 pianos and 32 hands. And I never wrote for piano, but I wanted to see if I can do what my teacher Barney always gave me as an assignment, that he wanted a piece of music that had two different energies, two different frequencies. One, you know, slow, one fast. And so I would write things that, you know, I'd use, like, you know, quarter note 20, eighth note 160, and he would say, no, that's just time. I want the energy, the frequency. And so I could never do it, you know. And then 33 years later, I wrote Orange Moon, where I had the pianos, and I had two different energies, two different frequencies simultaneously, but they were really kind of separate, but they were married. And so Jim Fox said, you know, you did it. You finally did. So sometimes it takes 30 years. But I guess I'm just saying, yeah, I am a musician. I am a composer. But go back to your punk rock days. And what are you composing now? Well, you are composing now.
Not for a while. You have to sit down. Yeah. And then your subconscious, you know, improv channels from the subconscious, and it comes out, you know. And you have to have a recorder going, though. Very important.
Do you know Cornelius Cardew, the Scratch Orchestra, the Manifesto, the Treatise?
I don't know.
The English group, and that's where Christian Wolff and Gavin Bryars, some of the English composers, came out of. But all that is aleatoric, where you look at symbols with music and you realize it, but there's a lot of freedom and a lot. You make choices while you're performing. But I think you might like that, the Cornelius Cardew Scratch Orchestra.
I don't know if I make choices ever. I think I just go with the first instinct.
Well, that's a choice. So,
but it's not conscious. It's just it's so fast you just do it. That's how editing happens for me. I don't think. I just do it. Uh-huh. But actually, I do think about it after it's done.
Yeah.
Like, was that, does that comma belong there or not? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Francis Saul, you know, when I was doing the Western form, which Marion worked on a long, long time ago. Long, long, long time ago. That was a disaster. But I actually got it done eventually on my own. Well, it's an interesting story. I talk about that. But basically, he said, just vomit out the story. Just imagine, you know, those pages are like magic pages, and whatever you write on it is going to become a film. But just vomit it out. Don't edit yourself, even if the, you know,
grammar's channel it out.
And then you go back, and you'll find, like, kernels of great stuff. He just recently asked me who owns the film. And I said, well, my company does, but, you know. Sure, yeah, we can talk. Anyhow, he let it sit on the shelf for 10 years because of a lawsuit. But I handled the lawsuit, and then I got Martin Sheen and Bobby Carradine to bookend it and got it out there. Did well in Latin America.
Uh-huh.
It always sounds good in Spanish. Yeah, well, films sound good in Spanish no matter what. I've always, when I look at a film that I've seen in English but then I hear in Spanish, I think it rocks. More so than other languages. Isn't that odd?
No, because I think sound is more important than image in films.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it all is sound, like I said, music. But, I mean, silent movies are awesome. But there's sound there, too, you know, in many ways, but in rhythm.
Well, sometimes people cater to the lowest common denominator, and then they enforce a live orchestra or a little synth group or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Or a piano player, instead of letting us just watch the film
That's silent, which
I would prefer, actually.
Yeah, that's true. But sometimes at the Castro, when they show a silent movie and that organ comes up, it becomes a live performance, a performance piece. You know, Carmine, my grandfather's Napoleon, with an orchestra, was like a performance piece, like a concert. And there's a place for that as well. So.
Yeah, especially the Castro with that fabulous organ.
Yeah, it's great.
Speaker systems everywhere. It's sort
Do they have the pipes too?
They're pipes.
Pipes, whatever. Whatever you call them.
Yeah, organ
they're
pipes.
Great.
Yeah, they're the best.
They're analog. They're not
analog.
Digital.
And they have acoustics, good acoustics in there.
Yeah.
For that. It's kind of nice when you go from the analog pipes to then the digital movie, back and forth. It's a good mixture, a good synthesis.
Oh, we're blessed to have the Castro Theater
in
San Francisco. May it be there forever, knock on wood.
It'll be there forever.
Well,
LA had great theaters in downtown, all the classic theaters just like that.
Grauman's Chinese?
Yeah, that's dope. But just in downtown LA, I can't remember the name, but they had movie palaces, and then they all shut down. But it was very similar to the Castro, but all over downtown LA. And, so basically, yeah, we have the Grauman's Chinese, but that's now has several theaters in it, even one big theater. So then there's the Egyptian, which is pretty nice. Yeah, it's nothing like the Castro. It's like one of the last great movie palaces. Yeah.
Wow. Has any of your films ever played there?
No.
What's wrong with them?
I will say, though, that San Francisco, has always been good to me in terms of my movie. It's Northern California, more so than L.A., because I am kind of a maverick and do my own thing. But when Deadfall came out, it was kind of a disaster for me, but it played at 3 theaters in San Francisco for a long time. The place on Fillmore, there was a place on Market, and then there was a place in the Mission. And it played for a while. And they kept moving it around, and that was cool. And then several film festivals. I believe Dracula's Widow played here, but the film festivals like Another Hole in the Head, Cinequest, Mill Valley, they've shown me support. And the Bay Area. I'd like to see film. The 70s, that's when my uncle started everything, and that was the last great golden age of Hollywood when the directors were in charge. But the studios decided that would never happen again, because they wanted to control everything. Money was spent. But there was, before that, a independent film world where San Francisco did make these films. And so I'd like to see that come back. And partly these films that I'm doing hopefully will do that, but it's very difficult to make these movies, and it's also difficult to have the funds. That's the hardest part, and to have cash flow. So I'm always dealing with cash flow issues. Now, you have to be an entrepreneur to be a filmmaker. It's hard to make I tell my students, you got to really be dedicated at filmmaking, feature filmmaking, which is expensive, though you can make a feature film for very little money. I have somebody that made one for $2,500, Tennessee. Not a bad movie, by the way. But, when you want actors and, some name actors, it usually you're going to spend between $200,000 to, a million. That would be considered ultra, ultra low budget. And then anything over $5 million up, $5 to $20 million is considered low budget Hollywood. Most films cost like $100 million, and it's kind of ridiculous. It's not easy. You have to, I always tell my students it's it changes, but filmmaking is 95% pure hell and 5% gold, but it's worth it for the gold just because it is. And Nona here always said, it's a privilege to be a film director, producer, which I like because, I complain, I sulk, I get mad. And so she'll say, remember, it's a privilege, and you've been doing it for 30 years. So it's good to remember that.
Hey, it's a privilege to be alive.
Well, in many ways, but then there's the idea of, the journey, right? The journey. No, it is a privilege to be alive, and we should be excited about that.
Yeah, well, you've had a pretty rich life, it seems like. I mean, you've got kids.
Yeah.
You know, you've traveled the world.
Yeah.
You got to discover the town where, on the Black Sea, where you Bautzen found
the circus. Yeah.
The circus, I mean, that's a bit of David Lynchian magic right there, all the shots there. I mean, what it reminded me of was David Lynch. Like, wow, it's a complete hermetic enclosed world.
Right.
And it's real. Oh, Sacred Blood, sorry.
Yeah, Sacred Blood. And it actually is going to, I mean, we're now in the process of selling it to different territories. And
Jesus.
And it's not easy to do that, but it's going to show... the first sale, which is non-exclusive, which means we can sell it, but it can sell to other places in Russia. It's a Russian 4K TV station, so that we made a little sale there, but it's non-exclusive, so that means we can still negotiate with other Russian distributors.
Hmm.
Sometimes when it's exclusive, then you lose the whole territory, and you don't want that, especially when the payment is very small.
And that's a tip for future filmmakers.
Right, right. I mean, that's why I teach my students. You have to be an entrepreneur, because first, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to raise the money. You know, still keep the idea you want to keep. You're going to have to throw a few things in there, which I probably should have done. I should have used a little bit of the Corman aspects of things you need to help sell the film. I don't want to go into what that is.
Product placement?
No, it's product placement, but like, you know, I did Dracula's Widow right out of art school with Dino De Laurentiis, and he kept telling me he wanted watermelons in the movie, and I'm like, what the hell are watermelons? And then I find out later they're, you know, big tits. And I'm like, that's what he wanted, and because it sells. Now at age, you know, my age now, making films, I get where he's coming from as the old pirate, but it depends on the movie. And Sacred Blood is not the kind of film that's appropriate, but it is a vampire film that probably should have been more blood and more killings, you know, more fighting to sell, because that's when people hear vampire, that's what they want to see. I just didn't see the film that way, but that's part of the problem I'm having. The other thing is, you know, you can make a little film and maybe make some money. I teach my students, you know, with Kickstarter, what's it called, Go-Go something?
Indiegogo.
Indiegogo and some other things now, too. But, you know, say you want to make a film and you're really into doing Romeo and Juliet, and you decide to do it, you know, on skateboards and surfers in Huntington Beach because they don't like each other. Skateboarders and surfers in Huntington Beach kind of clash, so you can have a skateboarder... you know, a guy and a surfer chick, you know, kind of falling in love. But you make it, you know, digitally with consumer cameras, but you can then go to, like, you know, skateboard companies and clothes and surfboard companies and clothes, tell them about your idea. You know, use Kickstarter, go after some name skateboarders that have never acted and surfers that want to try it. And you can raise the money and you can make it and probably sell it pretty well, you know, because of that built-in market. So that is what I mean by being an entrepreneur. We probably should think about that for one of the films. Skateboard surfing love story might be a good idea. Might be a good idea based on... Maybe that should be added to my slate. What do you think?
Well, you can also add the coming, you know, sport involving people who can do crazy ESPN stuff with those... tiny little hoverboards you'd stand
on
zoom down the sidewalk. They're just that big.
Yeah. No, I've seen those.
I've almost been knocked over by them. So, no, I don't mind it because...
Well, I would mind it. I'd get pretty mad.
I mean, I'm exaggerating when I said that. I saw them coming.
You probably put yourself in the middle.
I didn't, but that was a total exaggeration. But I could see in the future how, you know, there could be issues with if there are hundreds of those on the sidewalk at rush hour trying to get home.
Right.
Any new technology I'm interested in.
Yeah, no, me too.
Because technology changes life.
It does, for really good and also really bad, you know. It's like, that's nothing. I mean, I'm just always really nervous that we'll all just be plugged in and not have a mind of our own. So it's, I always say it's very important to stay in charge or stay charged, like to let your own battery handle the technology and not always have to be plugged in, you know.
Yeah, get some sunlight so that you're literally charging the body's battery with vitamin D.
Vitamin D, and that's like D batteries, right? So there's a lot of things going on there.
Darn right. Now, what do you think about something like Blair Witch Project, which I heard was made on nothing but the tape cost?
Yeah, no, that was a low-budget film. But then you got to realize, and it's the same with Robert Rodriguez's first movie, the Hispanic Western gangster film. I can't remember the name of it. El Mariachi or something. And that was made for $7,000. But then when it does well at festivals and a studio shows interest and a ton of money... Not a ton, but, you know, money that goes into the marketing, goes into, you know, improving the sound. And, you know, they had a whole you know, marketing campaign, you know, and then that helped sell the film. And it made, you know, it's kind of a fluke, but every once in a while, I mean, that film made $100 million. El Mariachi didn't, but it made money and it launched his career. And then you had the, you know, Paranormal film that wasn't made for very much, but the same thing, you know, a lot of money put into it. So if a studio gets behind it, you know, more than likely, especially if it wasn't made for much money, it'll make money. But then I found out, you know, they did that with Caligari, you know, which make a great movie. When Caligari was made, before it came out, there was graffiti put around the walls that said Caligari, Caligari, and then they would talk about who is Caligari, and Caligari, who is that? Then the film came out, and that was, you know, so there's always been this kind of marketing idea, which is cool, you know.
You don't mean the cabinet of Caligari, the silent movie.
Yeah, that's how long ago.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, but they did a marketing campaign before it came out where they would have graffiti artists, painters, write Caligari all around the city, and people go, what is Caligari? Who is Caligari? So when the film came out, they actually had viewers. So that was pretty amazing.
Was that in Prague or somewhere?
No, it was in Germany.
Germany.
I can't remember. It was
Bremen somewhere. Wien.
Yeah, probably Bremen, the place of the animals. I love the place of the animals. Was it donkey, dog, rooster, cat? They saved the town from the thieves. I love that place, Bremen. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There should be more movies involving cats. Hey.
Well, yeah. I have a cat who's famous named Biker Cat Otto, who was on Animal Planet. What was that movie that was Queen Bee? And it was all in the 70s. It was a Queen Bee. And
Queen
I think
Bee.
David Shire wrote the music for it. And there was all these other bee ladies.
Oh, I love the bee invasion of the bee women or something.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it was that, but we can look it up. But the women would sleep
the beehive women.
And they would die during sex from a sting.
The men would.
The men would.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, but it was a bit, you know, it was the same time when those movies came out with the giant, well, Willard. During all that time with the rats, but also the one, you know, Something of the Gods, where they had giant, you know, centipedes and things like that. It was all in that period. I know David Shire wrote the music, who was Talley's first husband, who wrote the great score for The Conversation.
Ooh, yeah. I love The Conversation.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I wish they hadn't torn that hotel down. I love that hotel. I like to go by it every time I went by to think of the movie, you know, or they use it as a facade.
Yeah.
It was on the Jack Tar. It was on Van Ness near Geary.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
That they shouldn't have torn that down.
You know what movie that's based on?
The Conversation?
Yeah.
No.
It was based on Clouseau's Le Diabolique.
Well, that's a totally different movie.
It's very similar in many, many ways.
It is?
Yeah, it's the twist at the end. And, you know, and you're thinking it's the couple, and the guy's going to kill the couple, but the twist is, no, the couple's going to kill the guy. And that's the end of Diabolique, very much so. But, I mean, I know that movie was looked at, obviously different, but that movie was looked at for the basic plot idea, the twist. The twist. Instead of a detective, it's a sound spy, you know, it's a spy. So there's some similarities there. I would have a double bill. You know, look at the double bill.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it still seems like there's a bunch of new plots that could be made.
Yeah.
You know, as technology has changed society.
That's true, though I do believe there's, you know, there's only, what, 7 human stories, and it's all variations of it, and Shakespeare did most of them. You can distill them all down to pretty much
what are those 7? I didn't know there were 7.
Well, I mean,
boy meets girl, boy wins girl, boy loses girl, boy turns gay. I mean, what are these 7 plots, I wonder?
I mean, all the Shakespeare plays. Let's go through those. You want to go through those?
No, I don't remember them.
King Lear, the guy that's an egotist.
Betrayed by his daughters.
Yeah, but and except for one that he didn't listen to.
Yeah, who Cordelia. Him,
she was banished, but, you know, that is a story.
Loss of power.
Not listening to the truth. But,
too much
know,
ego.
The tragic love story, but... You know, I mean, I know things can be distilled down, and that doesn't mean that there's no originality, but the basic themes you can find through, I mean, the Bible has them, right? You know,
maybe.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's some books on it. Joseph Campbell talks about it, Hero with 1,000 Faces. And we're all tuned into that, and that kind of mythology, and Mircea Eliade talks about it, and Star Wars used that, which is why it was so successful. I'm not going to get into Star Wars. I'm more of an Apocalypse Now guy, but Godfather guy, but not so much into that. But, you know, all these superhero films Superman is basically, you know, the story of Jesus. God's only son is crucified, comes back, and then you have the whole thing with Kal-El, the young Superman on planet Kryptonite, and then he's like the Jesus figure saving everybody. There's a lot of stuff that you can find that are stories that exist. I mean, even you know, religion comes from other religions. I mean, you know, the Romans had Saturnalia. We made that Christmas. And then you have the Druids with their spring rites, with rabbits, which have a lot of babies. And so what do we have for Easter? And, you know, we have the Easter Bunny. So they incorporated a lot of these things throughout the past.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that that happens, I mean, I think you can reduce things down to some basic story, human stories that, you know, that developed as we developed. And we base a lot of it on that, keep pushing it. But if you distill them down, I think you can distill them down to a core group of stories, kind of like Primary Colors.
Is that a movie?
No, it's a good movie. But Primary Colors, you know, and then you combine them and then you get different colors, but they still start with the primary colors, right?
Yeah, red, yellow, and blue.
Right.
Oh, and green and purple. And...
all come from those colors.
Oh.
So it's just kind of a similar idea, primary stories. So how are we doing? Are we good?
Did
I talk? We're good.
But this is not live, right?
No, so hell
could,
no.
You could do some editing.
Of course. There always needs to be some editing.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
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 Because I do it live, too, sometimes.
Yeah, we could have done it live.
Yeah.
Really? I didn't.
Well, we can't stream it
live.
We're not set up for that.
No.
I'm set up for it once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, the only problem with that is if there's a technical glitch right away, people tune off and then look at the archive version. But I need to get that to work because live internet television is kind of big.
Is it?
You know, it's TED, you know, all these big places that, you know, conventions and.
Well, do they have a delay in case somebody like swears or something?
Well, they have.
So they can bleep it out.
Yeah, there are things like that, and then also with the live Twitter and texting, you know, chatting, you have a moderator that can immediately look and, you know, delete comments and stuff. Certain things do get in there, but yeah, you know.
Yeah.
And then you would have a disclaimer. These people we don't know. They're, you know, something may happen, and so excuse any kind of bad language or things like that. A disclaimer, so they can't really. They're prepared.
They've apologized in advance.
In advance, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, this was fun.
Do you want to talk about your blog briefly?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I should do that.
What blog?
And
where do you find it?
www.christophercoppola.com. You need to have a blog. So we opened up ChristopherCoppola.com, which has a blog where I talk and interview people. You see pictures. You have links to movies and that sort of thing. But the thing about the blog is it interconnects everything in the social networking world, like Facebook, which I have quite a few followers, Twitter, which I have quite a few followers, and it brings it all together. And that's called influencing.
When you say you're interviewing people, it's transcribed then?
Yeah, but also video. I could do video and post that. I can do, what is that called? I can do a chat. You know, there's a lot. I mean, a blog basically, you should do it every day, and that is kind of hard. I do it every day on Facebook because, you know, usually that's where I have most of my fans, but we have to figure out how to get the Facebook to immediately go on the Christopher Coppola blog. And we have a lot to do yet with the blog. We just launched it. There's a lot to do. But I will put stuff up about this, put links to research, you know, on that. And then the Facebook people, it's almost 20,000. Yeah, I'm in a money mode because I got to raise this money to finish my Jungle Glam movie.
Jungle Glam?
It's a Jungle Glam movie. That I have five more days. But Jungle Glam, it only means
that. What's that mean?
Well, it's like in the 50s that no matter what, how, you know, if there's tarantulas and bugs on you, you're sinking in mud, you're dolled up. Like the actress is made up. She should look good. And same with the guy, you know. So no matter what's going on, I want that. I don't want it to be, real that way. It's like that old 50s style filmmaking, you know, doll them up. And so we called that Jungle Glam.
Wow.
Yeah. But there's a lot of pain in it, too. So, but no matter what, doll them up, okay? No matter what.
I have to admit, when he said Jungle Glam, all I could think of was, you know, platform shoes and big hairdos. And,
yeah, no, this, you know, is more glam. Like makeup and the lipstick and the hair done and, you know, that kind of stuff. The way it was done.
Now, you should have put platform shoes in the jungle. Well, that would have been funny.
Nobody's going to be looking at that.
No, I'm just kidding.
Then it just makes it dangerous.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we had mud. We had one-step snakes, fertile ants. It was a tough
shoot.
Great. Yeah. The bulk of it shot. We just have five more days of shooting in San Francisco.
Everybody survived so far.
I would have to say, I there was a time that I didn't think I was going to survive. It was probably the hardest day of my directing. There was a Mayan... an actual Mayan ruin that we were shooting on this private property.
Ooh, nice.
And we have to build around it to really make it, well, do some CGI. But that's where the treasure is hidden that this guy's fixated and is willing to kill to get and manipulate psychologically to get.
Wow. Yeah. On that note.
Yeah.
I guess we'll sign off, right? It was a pleasure, Mr. Vail, always is. I've known you for a long time. I know Marion and... you know, you guys have been watching my career for a long time, since 1983, and I've been watching you, and I have great respect for research, and you've made me a big fan of Eden Abbez, and I want to make
good.
A movie on that guy.
Ooh. It
would be an awesome movie, you know.
Oh, really, yeah.
Be. Really would be. We should talk.
Now, there's an independent.
Totally independent. Hard to sell, but, you know, it's usually the other way around, but it's like a, you know, white guy, you know, searching for the great black guy. Give him the song. So you got, you know, Eden and then Living Under the Hollywood Sun, eating nuts and berries, and then you have Nat King Cole, who made the song big, and he puts it under his door. It's a, you know, it's a great story. I like that in the Cliff Notes, isn't it? I mean, in the liner notes, you mentioned something about him walking this Hollywood Boulevard wearing like a robe, toga kind of thing. And a cop comes up to him and goes, what are you doing? What are you wearing, you know, in the 50s? And he says to him, you know, I may look weird on the outside, but see all these people? They're all weird in the inside. And the cop goes, you know, you got a point, bub. And he let him go. I love that.
I'll roll with that. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Coppola.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
You've been listening to another episode of Research Conversations with host V. Vail, brought to you by Research Books. Find us at www.researchpubs.com. Thank you.